This week on The Vergecast, we have billionaires doing weird billionaire things. We've got the Cybertruck from Elon Musk. We've got his trial about his bad tweets. We also have the founders of Google leaving and a little bit of Qualcomm at the end.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at deloitte.com/us/engineeringadvantage.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Greetings, mobile accomplishers. Welcome to The Vergecast. I am Dieter Bohn, not Nilay Patel. He is out this week, but that's okay because I am joined by a bunch of other people. Paul Miller is still here.
Hello.
Hey, I also have Casey Newton.
What's up, fam?
And Andy Hawkins.
Hey now.
How's it going?
Good.
So we have got a bunch of stuff. We haven't done a Vergecast chat show in a few weeks because of the Thanksgiving holiday. Instead, we had the pirate radio episodes. And if you skipped over them, shame on you. Go back and listen to them. They are amazing. But here today, right now, I think we've got 3 weeks worth of news and we're not going to hit all of it. I'm sorry. But we are going to talk Cybertruck basically the whole time. Just kidding. We'll do some other stuff.
We could talk about Cybertruck the whole time. That interesting. It's interesting to me, a person who does not care about trucks.
Okay, so I need two numbers. A scale of 1 to 10, 1 being what the hell, God, no, 10 being actually, yes, this is amazing design. I want your first number to be your first reaction and your second number to be how you feel about it right now. Go.
My first reaction was like, it was not numerical because it scrambled my brain. I didn't think it was real. And within about 24 hours, I moved all the way to a 10. I am a Cybertruck stan.
Wow. Andy?
I give it 2 heavy metal balls smashing into windows.
I was like a 3, and I'm a hard 9 now, I would say.
Really? Huh. Everyone has sort of come around on this thing.
I'm not. I still think it's ugly.
Okay.
Here's my main thing. Like, I can't remember the last time I saw an interesting vehicle that wasn't in a TV show or a movie, right? Like, there's just been nothing that has actually caught my attention. And, you know, obviously they have to make this thing and ship it, and it has to, you know, be a safe way of transporting people around. But if it accomplishes that, I actually think this will be an iconic vehicle of the 2020s.
I mean, it already... is it's going to hit DeLorean status in terms of like
but what happened to the DeLorean?
Well, this is what I was trying to get.
It went back to the future after reaching a certain number of gigawatts,
88 okay. miles per hour.
Let's back way up. I'm sure that if you're listening to the show, you know that Elon Musk got on stage and announced the Cybertruck, his long-awaited pickup truck. It is, I don't know, the 5th Tesla model that has been announced?
There's 2 Roadsters. There's the semi-truck. There's the Model S, the Model 3, the Model X, the Model Y.
If you're new to the Vergecast, something that we'll sometimes do is we'll just name all of the products that a company makes. So that was that segment for this week.
Let's not forget, Elon was trying to spell out sexy with the names
That's
of
right.
his cars.
Yeah. Well, and also just using the word cyber for the Cybertruck, like he
watched that like first demo of the CD Projekt Red game, you know, that came out next year, like Cyberpunk 2077. Yeah, like, I want this, but as a truck.
Right.
Well, there's already a great video that came up with inserting the Cybertruck into the N64 GoldenEye game, where it's kind of like pixelated nature just fits in perfectly with like that right. 90s era masterpiece.
Besides, it's an electric pickup truck. What is the big selling point of the Cybertruck? Like, what is Tesla trying to do with this thing, and how is it trying to differentiate it?
I mean, clearly, he was trying to sell it as this sort of like post-apocalyptic dystopian vehicle that we could all be driving around in as like the society crumbles down around us, which is arguably a pretty cool concept when you think about it. But I think it's also, you know, at a higher level, it's Tesla realizing that the pickup truck market is gigantic in the United States. And that's something that Tesla clearly wants a piece of. And whether or not this is going to be the thing that actually competes with things like the Ford F-150, which, let's just be realistic, Ford sold 900,000 Ford F-150s last year. I mean,
oh my God.
It's the number one vehicle in America. And Elon wants to compete with that. Is this the car to do it? I don't know.
Right. The F-150 is the most popular car. And that was my narrative going into this. I was not watching any of the teasers or anything. So I assumed he's going for the king. And instead he made like car fan fiction for me, like personally. A guy who does not have a car and does not want a car.
Well, okay, so number one, if you're trying to make a car for the apocalypse or the post-apocalypse, maybe don't make a car that depends heavily on an international half-built-out network of chargers on any electrical grid.
I do think it should have had like a hand crank generator like in the back if they were really going to commit to that bit.
Yeah.
I think it's just like, you know, this is a market where like people are very entrenched in the trucks that they buy. That, you know, somebody buys an F-150. 10 years later, they buy another F-150, and then 10 years after that, they buy another one. And I think he needed something that was radical and different enough to sort of like shake the cobwebs out of people's brains when it comes to pickup trucks.
Right.
And I think that maybe was maybe some of the motivating factor behind this. But it's just sort of like it's going to take something a little bit better to do that. It's not that great of a deal, I think, in the long term. If you just sort of look at the prices that are being offered for the three different models, people can get cheaper trucks with better towing capacity and all the sort of other things that matter for truck buyers, you know, in some of the more established brands. So it's, I think, like, if you just sort of look beyond, like, the crazy design and Elon and the bulletproof siding and the supposed shatterproof glass that shattered easily, there's really not too much there. And I think that maybe they might have to do some rejiggering on this thing before it actually comes out in 2 years.
Right. Well, assuming that he gets it done in 2 years. So talk to me about truck stuff, because you just said it doesn't have the towing capacity of much cheaper trucks. But isn't like one of the big selling points of an electric vehicle is that it has all that torque and it's also heavy and it is able to do the kind of truck stuff that you would want a truck to do?
Totally. Amazing torque. The 0 to 60 times that this thing was posting are pretty incredible. They were talking about for the triple motor all-wheel drive version, which just has an astonishing 500 miles of range, 14,000-pound towing capacity, and 0 to 60 in under 2.9 seconds. That's insane specs right there. And he wants 70,000 for that. That sounds good on paper, but how it's going to actually come out in reality, I think, is really going to be sort of the key thing to watch, because they've done towing tests with the Model X, and as soon as you start towing stuff with that thing, it loses like 50% of its battery power. So you're talking about a scenario where you're driving this thing around, and all of a sudden you're towing your boat or your camper or your flatbed, whatever. And all of a sudden you have to stop every 2 hours to totally recharge your Cybertruck. Plus this thing is just not designed to fit the current supercharger network too. I mean, they just didn't build the supercharger network to with this kind of thing in mind. This is a giant truck. It's like 2.5 feet longer than like most trucks on the market today. It's like, it's crazy long. It's not going to fit in people's garages or like in their driveways even. It's just kind of like, so Sean O'Kane, our reporter, was at the event, covered it for us, did an excellent job doing a video. Everyone should go check it out. It's an incredible video on our site. And his reaction initially in taking a ride in the thing was like, God, there's so much room in this thing. It's really like so roomy. I mean, that's because it is like insanely long. It's like, so I wrote this down. It's 232 inches long, which is 2.5 feet longer than a Chevy Tahoe. And a Chevy Tahoe is a giant truck. It's like,
oh my God.
It's like 4 feet longer than a Model 3. It's just kind of like, I just don't understand who this is supposed to be for, really. I think, is my kind of like...
Master Chief.
Well, it's for me. I mean, I want a ridiculous truck. First of all, I already have a great idea for a viral video. Uh-huh. You guys ready for this?
Let's
do it. So we're going to get one of these cyber trucks, and then we're just going to try to parallel park it throughout San Francisco on various hills, just like that for 12 minutes. Come on. That's going on the front page of YouTube.com any day of the week.
It's got it'll theoretically probably have the smart summon feature that Tesla rolled out recently, where you can like summon your vehicle autonomously to come to you in a parking lot. So that's going to really scare the hell out of some like grandmother in like a Costco parking lot. I can't wait to see that video too.
See, like, I didn't even know it could do that. Everything I hear about this truck, I want the truck more. I got rid of my car this year. I didn't think I would ever have a car again. Now all I can think about is getting a Cybertruck.
Do you want a Cybertruck? Because if it you know, you hit a pedestrian, they're definitely dead instead of probably dead.
Well, I mean, that's car. You know, I mean, part of that extra 2.5 feet is, can it move a body? And the answer is yes.
I've got like a theory on truck buyers. I'd like to run it by you all, just get some feedback. I feel like there's three main types of truck buyers. There is a person who literally needs to like pull horses around or like a stump out of the ground, right?
Yep.
Then there's the person who needs a dependable thing that has like a trunk that you don't mind getting dirty, you know?
Sure.
Like I need I think that's probably the most popular usage of a truck is someone who's just, they drive it to work and they put their tools in the back or that kind of thing. And then there's someone who wants to move bodies or like wants the literal largest thing on the road so that no matter what they hit, if they hit a house, the house moves, you know, that
yeah,
kind of
right.
mindset.
It's, you know, it's the macho looking toy for rich people. I think that it's that last one that you mentioned, Paul, that's really going to appeal to people. It's not going to be the F-150 killer. It's not going to be the Chevy Tahoe killer. It's going to appeal to people who like maybe we're thinking about buying like a Mercedes G-Wagon or something like that, like a really rich looking kind of like SUV or truck that they can like drive around in and feel macho.
It's the 2021 version of the Hummer is what
yes.
you're saying.
Yes. Oh,
it
God.
Definitely has old school Hummer vibes,
yeah.
doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which is, but see, the Hummer always like seemed ridiculous in a bad way to me. And like Cybertruck seems ridiculous in a good way.
Is it because it's called Cybertruck?
That's a huge part
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, it does help.
I mean, it
lot.
Has yeah. personality, and personality goes a long way, right?
And then, okay, he claims that they made a four-wheeler to go with it.
Yeah, an ATV.
Was it really like a completely brand new Tesla ATV, or was this like a not a flamethrower situation where they just like rebadged something?
Yeah, we don't have a lot of information on this ATV. They've okay. released no specs on it, no details really. It just kind of like appeared at the very end because Elon Musk is known for pulling things out of his sleeve at these splashy events, and they needed something to come out at the very end to sort of complement the truck. But yeah, you know, ATV, that's cool. Yeah, why not?
Sure.
Has anybody mounted a flamethrower to Cybertruck yet?
Oh, I think they're, after they listen to this podcast, they certainly will.
Just like if they ever make a sequel to Mad Max Fury Road, it'll 100% begin with like a fleet of Cybertrucks with flamethrowers on them, like cresting a hill. And it's going to be amazing.
Yeah. Speaking of how big this thing is, if after you watch Sean O'Kane's video, go find Simone Geertz's video. She calls it Truckla. She made a pickup truck out of a Model 3. So she, against Tesla's wishes, drove it to the Cybertruck unveil and like parked it on the street next to where they were like doing the test drives. And so you see the Cybertruck go by what is essentially a Model 3. And it looks like you could fit three Model 3s inside it.
Or one Model 9.
It's like, yeah. What could have been if they had gone like maybe in a more like reasonable direction instead of fulfilling Elon Musk's, you know, Blade Runner inspired fantasies?
Here's my question. Let's say they had just done like the Tesla version of the Ford F-150. Like they just like made a Ford F-150 that, I don't know, looked vaguely different because it had an electric battery. Would all of the chatter have been like, ooh, like Elon Musk is a secret genius. He's really going to like steal the thunder of the Ford 150. Or, which I think is more likely, would we all be sitting around being like, look at this boring truck. What a missed opportunity. Why doesn't anyone ever make cool vehicles anymore?
I don't think so, because when the Model 3 came out, it wasn't like on the surface revolutionary. It was sort of like what was going on underneath that was really kind of like amazing about that car. And I still think it's like maybe the most important. It's still the most important electric car. And maybe a lot of car people think it's the most important car, period, to have ever been released. Just because it's got great specs. It's got a great price. It just like, you know, it makes you feel things when you drive it. It's got all this cool tech inside. It just sort of checks all these boxes. And it didn't have this wildly polarizing design. You know, it was pretty, you know, it looked like a Tesla. It looked like a, you know, a little bit maybe in line with the Model S and the Model X, obviously. Yeah. This is just so far beyond anything else that the company itself is doing that, yes, it feeds into this notion of Elon Musk as this, like, evil genius of type, you know, where obviously his Twitter account is getting him into huge amounts of trouble these days.
Uh-huh.
More to come on that. But, it didn't seem like it fit with like the company's overall lineup that already existed. And so it just kind of like threw everyone for a loop. I mean, you look at you mentioned Simone Gertz. You look at her video. You should just look at her face when the thing is revealed on stage. And I feel like that, like, these are people that love Tesla and like really admire what he's been doing, and have like a lot of respect for, you know, maybe they don't like Elon Musk as a person, but they feel like the company itself is involved in a very, you know, noble project, and their products are really cool and people want them. This is the thing that like really is dividing Tesla fans, which is really kind of shocking.
So here's what I love about the design of the truck. I love that doesn't look like a knockoff Ford F-150. I love that it's different. But I'm having a difficult time like identifying like, yes, finally, we should make cars look different because they have different drivetrains. And so you can change the shape of a car now. And did you need to make this particular shape? Right? Like something else that maybe I might have liked better.
So. And Musk has always said that this is sort of like, this is his favorite car that Tesla has made. And this, there seems to be this implication that this is like just his secret vanity project that he's been working on for a really long time, which that's fine. You can do that. And you're a billionaire, dude. You can do whatever you want. Basically, you have the money to do it. It just doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to be the thing that changes Tesla or changes the truck market even. He's said this too. This might not sell at all, and we might have to do a more standard looking pickup, something that's a little bit more normal for people, for the normies out there who love their trucks. Yep.
So in which case, like, the whatever number of them they do make will instantly become the most like valuable cars on the secondary market probably ever made.
Yeah.
Do you think that there was a moment when like he saw the first one roll off the production line and he just was like, went absolutely mad with power and was like, there's nothing that I can't do. Like, look what I made people make for me and it exists now.
Oh, yes. I honestly feel that like lightning started to strike in the sky and dark clouds gathered over his head as he like, you know, lifted his hands into the air and, you know,
Cybertruck cometh.
So we're 2 years out, a year and a half out to this thing, actually, his claim.
Yeah, they said the end of 2021 for the first two models and not until 2022 for that tri-motor version. So, yeah.
Do you think he could pull this off? I mean, he's technically no longer in production hell with the Model 3.
It will all depend on the gigafactories that they have under production right now, because the Fremont factory is at capacity. They don't have the space to make anything else but Model 3s really at this point. Barely Model S and X's anymore. They don't have room to make the Model Y, which is the next vehicle they have coming out. They definitely don't have room to make the semi truck. So it will depend on the ones that the factories that they have under construction in Shanghai, and they just announced they're going to be building a new one in Berlin. So yeah, it'll all depend on those.
Well, I can't wait.
You going to buy one?
No. Listen, I know I said I was going to buy
it's
one.
It's $100 deposit, serious. Casey. Come on, do it.
I honestly don't have $70,000 for a car right now. Nor do I have literally
anywhere to park it. We got until the end of
2021
to.
Well, I would also need to like buy a parking garage.
Yeah,
I do have $100.
Yeah,
I'm not about these pre-order schemes though. Like, I don't like that. But smart. I'm sincerely so glad that he made this thing and is putting it out in the world. Like, there's so like look at how bored you have been with most smartphones over the past 3 years, right? Is like if nothing else, I hope this inspires designers of other gadgets to be like, what if we went 20% crazier than we were planning to? Like, that's what I want to see.
And this was it busted out beyond like our little world of like tech and design nerds just like talking right. about this stuff. I mean, like I was just talking to Paul about this. This was like a topic of a conversation at my Thanksgiving dinner table right. this year, where yeah. like my wow. mother-in-law was like, does it have carpeting inside? It looks really nice. I think I want one.
Does it have carpeting inside?
That's a good question.
I don't know.
Yeah, man.
I imagine it's all like black, like dominatrix leather inside.
For me, what makes it, what converted it from a 3 to a 9 is that I love sci-fi and I've seen a lot of sci-fi, and it kind of bugs me when I see sci-fi cars because I know that under the hood is like a Toyota Corolla, and then yeah. somebody put a lot of paper mache on top of it. And so it was cool to see, like, I mean, I don't know all the ins and outs of the car, but at least I'm being sold that it's like an exoskeleton. It's utilitarian, like that this is what the future has to look like. And I know it's not true. It doesn't have to look like that. And you could just put a regular metal skin on a frame and probably get just as good or better performance. I don't even know. But it felt like a marriage of this car is actually a functional thing. And it also looks like, it really looks like this. It's not just dressed up to look like
it. It also looks like it's going to just chew up pedestrians underneath it. I mean, like, the thing with all those sharp angles and stuff, I mean, there's been a lot of people to note that it's unlikely that this car would be approved in the EU because of, like, they have very strict, like, pedestrian safety regulations. Mm-hmm. And this doesn't sort of meet the design criteria to meet approval. So, like, I mean, in the US, we don't care, you know. Thousands of people die every year in car accidents. And
what if for the EU version, they had a rule where the Cybertruck could never stop honking?
I want to see. So if you imagine F-150 is full polygons, like the highest resolution level of detail truck, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And then you scrub that down
yeah.
all the way to like the truck that's like, you know, 10 miles off in the distance in the video game. You know, it's yeah. just a few polygons, just a suggestion of a truck, right?
Yeah.
And that's what the Cybertruck is. Uh-huh. If you scrubbed that polygon scrubber like one or two notches up, I think just that would make it a 10. And it possibly, okay. in a sense, it'd make it a little rounder, maybe just slightly less pedestrian deaths. I don't really know really how to solve that problem, but just throw that
I
out
mean,
there.
You need a crumple zone. Like, cars need crumple zones in order to absorb impact from the crashes that they encounter. And this yeah. car does not appear – this truck does not appear to have a crumple zone. So it's yeah. sort of like – I mean, it's not – again, it's not like a requirement – in the places like the US, but it's nice to have.
You know what happened? Elon Musk was in the hot tub and somebody got high and asked, why don't they make the whole airplane out of the stuff that they make the black boxes out of? And he's like, I have a great idea for a truck.
I mean, like, yeah, but you know, if it actually held up to that kind of scrutiny, I mean, they were like, he's like, check out this armor resistant glass, and it broke like yeah. right away, and that became the thing that everyone talked about afterwards. And then afterwards, he's like, oh, we shouldn't have hit it with the sledgehammer because that compromised the integrity of the armor plated glass. But it's just kind of like, why do we need these like bulletproof? Like, I guess maybe if you're some sort of like, you know, like a billionaire, that's the kind of thing you go for.
But to me, this is like that moment was just such a great example of the accidental genius of Elon Musk. Like, because on one hand, like the fact that it broke just led to like, you know, so much coverage, right? Everybody showed that clip. Like, how can you not? But at the end of the day, it cost them nothing, because if you tell the average consumer, are you willing to buy this truck even though the window glass might break if you throw a rock through it? Like, most people would be like, yeah, that's a risk I'm willing to take, you know? So it was just like the whole thing was genius. I bow to this person.
Wow. Amazing. Okay. What about the Ford Mustang Mach-E, though?
This is what I was just going to say. Is like the entire electric car conversation has been nonstop Tesla for years and years and years. But at the LA Auto Show, and then just like in general, watching other like electric car announcement, it seems like finally we're going to have more adoption of electric vehicles from the other car makers in a real way instead of a half-assed way. Am I too optimistic by thinking that when I look at this Mustang Mach-E and be like, okay, now they're finally in the game?
No, I think absolutely not. I think you're absolutely right. I think Ford's back in the game. Porsche is definitely in the game with the Taycan. We did a first drive with that recently, and again, go check it out. The video's on the Verge. It's amazing. Sean did an incredible job in Viren. But it, you know, these are two cars that the Taycan obviously came out earlier, and the Mach-E is not going to be coming out until a couple years from now. But it's still on paper. It looks fantastic. The price is right. The specs are really good. These are things that EV people that are interested in EVs are really looking at. Plus, these are two automakers, Porsche and Ford both, where you can still get a really nice tax break from the government because it still exists for those two companies. So that's $7,500 off your sticker price right there. Tesla doesn't have that anymore. And that's something that really helped that company early on in the early days. But now the playing field is going to be something more level, I think, for them. And I think Ford is a nameplate that people know. The Mustang, especially. I mean, there's a lot of grumbling about people Ford putting the Mustang name on this thing. They could have called it any number of ridiculous car names, but they chose Mustang. That's their most recognizable brand name, and they want to really go with something that can compete in the market against Tesla. So not a sports car. This is a crossover.
Yeah,
and it looks good. I think it looks. I mean, like it's got some weird design styling to it. But I think overall, I think it's. And we'd have to obviously drive it first. But I think on the surface, it looks pretty good.
Yeah, it's actually a shame that noted Mustang enthusiast Neil Patel is out this week.
That's tough.
I went on the same journey with this car that I sort of went with the Cybertruck, just on a much smaller scale. I initially was like, this looks dumb. Why'd they call this a Mustang? All of these things were mistakes. And I don't know. I've come around. I actually think that I don't have strong feelings about what a Mustang is, other than wanting to make jokes about it to troll Neli, which is not nice of me, but it's a thing that I do. But you know, I think that they needed to put a brand on it that drove interest and attention. And if they had just called it a Fusion, we would not care.
Yeah. Again, this is like another kind of good troll, because if the chatter that your product generates is a bunch of Neanderthals saying, no, like you can't make the Ford Mustang a progressive vehicle that will save the world. Like those are the exact right enemies that you want, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I saw the story when it hit the Verge. Immediately forgot what the car looked like because my standard is now Cybertruck. pulled it up again, and it's a very nice car. It also blends totally into the background. Like this car will drive by you, and you will not like turn your head to the left.
Not everybody wants to make a statement when they drive around. Most people don't want to make a statement. Maybe Tesla people probably do. But most people are just looking for something that's going to get them from point A to point B, and maybe we'll save them a little bit of money in the long term. And obviously, if you look at things like the cost of ownership over the total cost of ownership for EVs, it's much better than cars with internal combustion engines. You're saving up to $1,500 to maybe even $2,000 a year on gas there. So it's going to look good. That's going to be the thing that's going to really speak to people. And if the point is to shift from polluting cars to non-polluting cars, from emission spouting vehicles to zero emission vehicles, we need cars with recognizable, trusted nameplates, and I think that's what Ford is going for here. And I think it's a good mainstream rival to Tesla. I think that should be welcomed, and I'm sure Elon Musk welcomes that too. His whole point was to shift the entire industry over to this, and it looks like it's finally happening.
Can I ask a really dumb question?
Sure.
Do all of these cars use different ports to charge?
So there's like it's a little unclear. I mean, obviously Tesla has its proprietary supercharger network,
yeah,
and they've done a really good job at sort of building that out, and that's definitely an advantage they have over a lot of other companies. You couldn't take your Mustang over there and plug it into a supercharger. Maybe there would need to be some sort of, I don't know, what would
dongle?
You call it? A dongle?
Yeah.
But no, there's Electrify America. There's a number of other companies that are owned by automakers that are building out charging networks that are now coming online. It's still very much a work in progress, and it needs to get faster and better in order to speed this adoption up. Or because that is the number one concern for people is, where do I charge this thing? Maybe I don't have a garage. You know, I have range anxiety. What am I going to do? And if you don't see out in the world, in your community, in the places where you travel the most frequently, EV charging networks in the same way that you see gas stations, then you're not going to be convinced enough to switch over.
Right. But like if everybody is using a different plug, so it's just going to take, you know, if there's four kinds of plugs, it's going to take four times as long, right?
Yeah, it's an issue. And I think that it's something that the automakers need to like sit down and figure out, because the point should not be to shut out Mustang Mach-E owners from Tesla's supercharging network, even though Tesla arguably could say, we spent all of this money investing in this thing. Why should we let other car companies' customers come and use it? But again, it doesn't really speak to the higher purpose that you're trying to achieve.
So, okay. The reason I'm not buying any of these electric cars is I don't have a charger in my garage in my apartment. So what I want to do is buy an electric bike. And apparently that's going to be okay for me to do, because they're coming back to – well, I mean, I could buy one anytime I want, but they're like, some of these bikes are coming back to New York and San Francisco, like the rent-a-bike stuff.
Yeah, the bike shares are coming back. Those are – so the ones in San Francisco and New York are both owned by Lyft.
Right.
It's Lyft bought this company Motivate a couple years ago, and they run both the bike shares. They released the electric bikes earlier in the year and hit a bit of a snag. There was some battery fires. Bleh. There was some braking problems.
Was the other viral video I wanted to make, by the way, was a Lyft bike catching on fire while I was riding it, but timing didn't work out.
What if it caught on fire in the back of the Cybertruck while you were parallel parking the Cybertruck?
Oh, boy. Say hello to going Megavi.
That would be the most metal video ever. It's just Casey, his hair aflames. It would look amazing. No, but they finally figure out these problems that they were having lifted with its e-bikes, and they're bringing them back. They're coming back, and I'm very excited. I feel like it's very good. I'm an e-bike evangelist. I love them. I ride them to work every day. It's like changed the way I get around in New York, I think it's a positive step for cities to be taking, because it's going to shift more people out of cars, hopefully out of Uber and Lyfts, and onto electric bikes, because they're great and they make you feel like a superhero, and I'm all for them.
Well, and apparently you also like still manage to get exercise from them.
You do.
You had a good article about that.
You do. They are not cheating. They feel like cheating because there is like some degree of effortlessness involved. But they've done studies that show that you still sort of enter into that kind of that zone that you're looking for of like vigorous physical activity, especially amongst mountain bike users when they use electric mountain bikes. So it's really kind of fascinating that like even though you feel like you're not doing as much physical activity, you're not sweating as much, you're still doing the right stuff for your heart, and it's a positive thing, and I think more people should use them.
Why did New York? I don't know as much about San Francisco, but why did New York have this war on electric bikes?
So they have a ban specifically on throttle bike, electric bikes, the bikes where you have like a little button or a knob that you turn and the bike goes without you having to use the pedal. It's just something that's been in the books for a long time. It's a little bit backwards in my opinion. And they've been using it to sort of unfairly discriminate against a lot of food delivery workers, many of whom are undocumented immigrants. It's kind of like a discriminatory thing. And they've proposed to change the law, to legalize them, but the scooters are kind of mucking up the legislative process because the city doesn't know how it wants the scooters to come in quite yet, even though like other cities like San Francisco and many others have sort of figured out how to like manage the scooters. New York doesn't quite realize that they can just sort of pick up what San Francisco is doing and do the same thing. And so it's kind of leading to the whole thing being kind of like drugged down and stalled. And yeah, it sucks. But I think they'll figure it out eventually. I don't know.
I mean, the main thing I want is just more lanes for all of these vehicles, bikes yes. especially. I used to commute via bike in Minneapolis, and I was too scared to do it in San Francisco just because it just felt like there just wasn't enough. They've gotten better, but it's still nowhere where it should be.
Yeah, ideally, the more people you have using these vehicles, and that's why the scooters, I feel like, are a net positive, because they're just going to have, as the city sees more people using them, it will hopefully make the decision that there needs to be more protective infrastructure, protected bike lanes, more parking, more separation between bike and scooter users and cars, so that people can feel more confident and not have to fear for their lives and fear of being crushed under the wheels of Elon Musk's Cybertruck when they want a bike to work. So yeah, if there's a good way to keep the Cybertruck separate from the cyber scooters, I'm all for it. Let's do it.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. Here's the story of innovation told in 5 words. Try. Explore. Connect. Pivot. Transform. See what happened there? As soon as Connect entered the story, innovation became achievable. That's why Deloitte works with clients and tech alliances to bring together the people, ideas, and technologies to overcome, solve, and of course, transform. Connect to what matters for innovation. Start at Deloitte.com/US/innovate.
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
All right, so what's going to happen is earlier today, I talked to Liz Lopato, who, as we are recording this, is at the Elon Musk trial for his tweet about the cave diver, calling him a pedo guy.
Some are calling it the cyber trial.
It is wild. By the time you listen to this, it might even be over. Who knows? But I talked to Liz about the things that are going on in there. So we're going to listen to that chat. But before we get there, Andy, you have a story coming next week I wanted to ask you about. You rode around in Waymo again?
I did. So Waymo, the self-driving subsidiary, spun out of Google a couple years ago. They've been testing their self-driving vehicles in the Phoenix area for a number of years now. And they gave me a ride in one of their fully driverless cars just the other day. It was great. I'm going to have a story coming up about that next week. It's really important, I think, because this is really the only company right now to be testing cars with no one behind the steering wheel on public roads. There's a lot of sort of caveats to that, which are interesting. But it is, I think, kind of like the future of that we're talking about when we're talking about driverless cars. This is actually happening. I rode in one. It was surreal.
All right. Well, keep an eye out for that. And here's Liz.
All right, Liz, you are in LA, right?
Yeah, for my sins, you know.
So, okay, this is the trial for Elon Musk over his pedo guy, or is it pedo guy tweet? Can you just like give us the broad sense of like what this trial is about and why you're there?
Yeah, I will say that pedo guy, which is how I pronounce it, has seen a wide variety of pronunciations. So pedo guy is also a thing that I have heard in the courtroom this week. Yeah, so basically what happened, I'm going to try to summarize this like sort of convoluted thing as succinctly as I can, is that you might remember last year there was this Thai soccer team with their coach who got lost in a cave system in Thailand. It was like a big international media kerfuffle. A bunch of people around the world organized to help rescue these kids, which they did successfully, thankfully. But as part of this, Elon Musk got involved. Primarily, it seems, because people on Twitter were asking him to get involved. So he was like, sure, we'll like build a mini sub. And he was in contact with the head of the dive team, who actually did rescue the kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, the testimony I heard was that the sub was considered potentially as a plan B, because plan A, the way they actually got the kids out, had never been done before. They were going to sedate the kids, take them underwater. They weren't sure if it was going to succeed or, like, if this would be too much for the kids who'd been in this cave for a while.
Yeah.
Well, like, frankly, pretty weak. So, you know, it was a lot happening very fast. And anyway, Musk makes this sub with SpaceX engineers over the course of a couple of days, and then brings it to Thailand and leaves. And one of the guys who was initially involved in the rescue, a guy named Vernon Unsworth, who was very involved at the very beginning, because he knows this cave system probably better than most anyone. At least that was the testimony I heard from the head of the dive team. But he was giving an interview with CNN where he was asked about the mini sub, and he said it was a publicity stunt and that he didn't think it was ever going to work.
Which, by the way, was like, in terms of like uninformed opinions, especially on Twitter, which is whatever, it was kind of like the default opinion. Like, sure, Elon, you can do anything, but maybe this one you shouldn't try and solve right now. Maybe just leave this one to the experts. But like the super fans were like, yeah, go do it. And like nobody really knew, but it seems like a cave diver who has been like diving in those caves, who knows how the logistics of like going into a cave works, might know. I don't know.
Well, there's that. It's also the fact that like the Financial Times had also said something pretty similar before, which we heard testimony about. So it's not like he was like out on a limb here, or he was alone. But for whatever reason, this really irritated Elon Musk, who sent out a series of tweets where he said that Unsworth was sus for living in Thailand, and then called him pedo guy, and then replied to someone who was like, this is in poor taste. Like, I bet you a signed dollar it's true. And then replied to someone else and said, don't you think it's weird he hasn't sued me yet?
So then he gets sued.
Right. actually, as it happens, when he said that, Lynn Wood, who is the lawyer who is in the courtroom this week, was like, hey, by the way, I've already sent you a letter saying that I plan to file litigation. Here's a copy. It's dated August 6th.
Right. All this happens. The trial has begun. And if I've learned anything about the way that high profile trials go from watching like tech trials, the thing that I think it's about ends up not being the thing that necessarily happens in the courtroom, because like the legal terms end up being on some, you know, arcane thing or some specific legal question in a way that like you wouldn't expect just from the original lawsuit. So looking at how they set up and talk to the jury and are like making their arguments, what is each side of this case? Like, what are they pinning their case on?
Well, so it seems like the question is whether Musk was recklessly negligent when he sent those tweets. And okay. I'm not a lawyer, but this is my understanding of the case. So like, you know, sorry to the lawyers who are listening to this. I don't have a law degree. But from the opening statements, it seems pretty clear that what the plaintiff is doing is saying, hey, Vernon Unsworth was called a pedophile by Elon Musk, and this was reported by the national media. I think they said there was something like 490 stories about it.
That seems low.
I don't know what date range they're looking at, right? Because, okay, like, sure. Like we've been writing about this for at least a year now. Like,
yeah.
Fine. So, whatever. So that's their argument, that he's been called a pedophile, he's been smeared, and that, you know, at this time when he should have been celebrating his heroic role in the rescue. And to be very clear, everyone in the court agrees that Vernon Unsworth is a hero, including the judge, including Elon Musk, everyone. You know, he has instead been dealing with this. And the defense is arguing, you know, this is not an accusation, it's an insult. This was a fight between men. Like, you know, literally that phrase was used. Like, this was shit talking. You know, Musk wasn't like trying to make a statement of fact when he called him pedo guy, which was a thing that we litigated for quite some time in the courtroom on Tuesday and Wednesday, what the meaning of pedo guy was understood to be.
The thing that happened, everyone should know, we're recording this Thursday morning before Liz goes into Thursday's day of trial. You'll probably be listening to this on Friday or sometime over the weekend. So there is a very real chance that by the time you hear our voices, this thing will like the either be completely done, or at least like the trial period will already be over, right?
That's right. We're expecting to send the case to the jury either at the end of today or the beginning of tomorrow, the beginning of tomorrow right. being Friday. But I would just like to note for our longtime listeners that this is a fine tradition from the old days of this day, this week in Elon, where inevitably I am like several days behind whatever is going on because so much is going on that, that other news has occurred.
So there's a few different like legal things to pick apart. And then we have to talk about some of the insane things that actually happened in the room and the insane things that somebody said. So one of the things that I would like as a person who loves language for this entire thing to hinge on is whether pedo guy is a statement or an insult, whether it's the same thing as calling somebody a motherfucker. Most people, when you call somebody a motherfucker, aren't literally implying that you perform that act, or if it's, he's actually making an accusation that he was a pedophile. And it's surprising to me that that is not a bigger part of the case. Like I figured the entire defense would rest on that.
I would have thought so too. Just for a little bit of background, one of my sins that has landed me in LA is that I was a philosophy major in college and I studied speech act theory for a while. Mm-hmm. And I have been absolutely fascinated by this whole thing, particularly around the nature of speech, sort of separately from the actual details of the case. And so if we think about insults, there's think about an insult like asshole, right? Like that's like one of the insults that actually is has more research on it.
Sure, okay.
So that's why I'm using it. But if you were to call me an asshole, this would be understood very clearly as being an insult. It might even be true. I mean, some people are assholes. I might be one of them. Who can say?
You're not. Just for the
thank record. You. I appreciate that. But it's very clearly an insult. It's very clearly not defamatory. There's no smear involved. That is a very clear cut case. Whereas sure. if you move to pedo guy, at least in my use, Musk has testified that it is known through the English speaking world to mean creepy old man, and that's not my experience.
It might be his if he's hanging out in weird corners of Reddit and Twitter, but I would agree with you that it's not the default experience.
No, it's not. So I don't know about that. Again, it would be nice to have a linguist to speak to it. But I do know that it is way less clear cut than asshole.
Yeah.
So that's part of the case. But the other part of the case is Musk's state of mind when he made what I'm going to refer to as the doubling down tweets, specifically the one where he says, don't you think it's strange he hasn't sued me yet? Because at this point, Musk had hired a private investigator, not directly, but through an employee, who it turned out was a con man and had been feeding him bad information.
The private investigator was a con man, not the employee, right?
That's right. Which, that's right.
To be clear, I assume the employee was the con man because he goes by Brick House. And I was like, that can't be a real human.
Well, that's not his name. Although right. I love it. I've been I've had She's a Brick House stuck in my head all day. Yeah. It's bad. But so this employee has used this pseudonym to book travel and other things for Musk because privacy is important when you're dealing with a celebrity. Fine. Sure. But anyway, so the con man PI sent a bunch of false information indicating that Unsworth was a pedophile. None of this is true, to be super clear, and I'm not going to repeat the details of the accusations because I think they're gross. But at this point, that was the information, the bad information, the wrong information that Musk had in mind when he doubled down and said, don't you think it's weird he hasn't sued me?
So, okay, so the defense is this is an argument among men, which is just, come on, what are you doing? This isn't Pistols at Dawn. And then there's also, can you just please explain the J-Dart defense? I prefer to think it's pronounced Jort, but his lawyer created an acronym called J-D-A-R-T, right?
Yeah, it's pronounced J-Dart.
That's too bad.
Listen. It's not the weirdest thing I've heard in court. not the weirdest thing I've heard in court this week. But so, okay, so Alex Spiro, who is Musk's attorney, he's the head of the legal team. He's represented Jay-Z. He's actually genuinely kind of a scary dude. Mm-hmm. Like, just imagine, like, Miles Teller, but, like, a lawyer, like, that kind of, like, very type A energy and, like, intensity.
Right.
So he says, oh, you know, this is Jadar. These were joking, deleted, apologized for, responsive tweets. And, you know, you have a gallery full of journalists, all of us, who immediately, like, were like, this is silly. But the argument seems to be, from the defense, that Musk's state of mind when he sent the initial tweets was that he was just trying to insult somebody who he felt had insulted him. There were a couple of things that Unsworth said in the CNN interview that were pointed to specifically as Musk responding to. That's right. what the responsive is about, the R in Jadart. So what Unsworth had said, wrongly, was that Musk had been asked to leave after visiting the caves, which he hadn't. But the reason that Unsworth thought this is because one of the things that the people on the ground knew was that on the rescue days, the only people who were allowed into the cave were the actual rescuers, the cave divers. So Elon watches this interview. He testified two or three times. He apparently saw it on Twitter.
Yeah.
Where else? And he fires off these tweets. He says they were off the cuff. He does a Google search beforehand and discovers an article that says that the place where Unsworth lived is known as a hotbed of child sex trafficking. So this is mistake number one, just for our audience, because I think that it is useful to know what not to do. Don't use a Google search in lieu of actual research.
Yeah.
Don't do it. Like, there are databases that can help you. They're more specialized. Use the Google to get to the database and then do the research. But then, too, so based on this, he's like, ah, yeah, this will be an effective insult, and then fires off the tweets.
Okay. So, hopefully, I don't know, did Jadart land with the jury? I don't know if you could see the jury, but, like, I have to imagine they're like, what?
Their expressions didn't change. I mean, like, the thing that I have noticed with the jury, they've been very attentive, is that they have mostly not really reacted. Like, they've laughed at a couple of things that are, I think, inherently funny.
Yeah.
But mostly they've just been like observing. I think it seems like they're taking their job really seriously. So that's nice. But there are times where they do seem to be growing bored, usually when the lawyers are fighting with each other and nobody is testifying.
Yeah, fair. Okay, so there's a bunch of like convoluted parts of the story, especially when you get into the timeline of, you know, when the private investigator said the thing to Musk, or when he found out about the lawsuit, et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole situation with justballs.com that I don't understand why it's relevant.
Okay, so this goes back to our friend James Brickhouse, a.k.a. Jared Burchell. And so as we're discovering, like, as we're talking about the pseudonym, this email is shown to the court, which, frankly, like, predates this entire trial, all of the controversy, whatever. And it is under the Brickhouse pseudonym, and it is an offer to buy the website justballs.com, which for research purposes I have visited. It is under construction, and there are a series of related searches there to baseball.
Great. Okay.
So, just balls.
Why is this relevant?
Because what the defense is attempting to do is establish that the pseudonym was not created specifically for dealing with the PI.
Oh, okay. Great. So, okay, is that the weirdest thing you heard in the court? Because that is awfully strange.
Oh, man. God, weirdest. I'm struggling to rank them. Because a lot of the moments that were really funny on the first day of the trial were like, okay, so here's the deal with judges, period. Is one, that they're a little older, and two, this is more relevant, they spend all day in court talking to people instead of being terminally online like the rest of us.
Great.
And so the first day in court was a bunch of explaining online to people who are maybe not online, including the judge. There was like confusion about what direction one should read an email thread in, and confusion about what direction one should read a Twitter thread in. Which I had never thought about the fact that they go in opposite directions, but if you don't do those things on a fairly routine basis, I can certainly see how it would be confusing.
Yeah.
And I don't know the level of the jury's online-ness. I don't know if they are, you know, committed shit posters or they have never touched a computer in their lives or what. But I would imagine that they are probably not as online as maybe you and I are, and maybe people who spend all day in front of a computer are.
Man. Okay, so there's a lot of hilarious things, there's a lot of strange things, but the most like emotionally affecting thing to me was the piece you put up after Wednesday's day of testimony, where it seems like Unsworth is like genuinely broken up about this. And maybe he's performing for the court a little bit, but just reading what you've written about it, it really seems like, all jokes aside, this is not a thing that is light and easy for him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, separately from whether the question of whether what Musk said about him was defamatory, it was clearly incredibly hurtful. So I just want to I want to give you a little sense of like why I am convinced of this, because it's going to be relevant in a second. But the courtroom layout is that I am sitting in the gallery and I am facing the judge. So that's the front and the back. And then between the two of us, there are two tables facing each other, the plaintiff's table and the defense's table. Okay. And then behind the plaintiff's table is the jury. So the jury can see the defense, but the Unsworth's back and his lawyer's backs are to the jury.
Okay.
So as Musk was testifying on Wednesday, and we were having this discussion about the various degrees of seriousness involved in pedo guy, and pedophile, I was watching Unsworth, who, to my knowledge, I didn't see him at all. My view was blocked on Tuesday, so I don't know... what he was doing then. But on Wednesday, I had a clear view of him. And he seemed like really unhappy with this conversation, like visibly unhappy, was shifting in his chair, was sort of like his mouth was working. He was like puffing out his cheeks. He looked miserable, man. And then he got up on the stage or the stand and said that he felt dirtied. He felt ashamed. He felt that he had been smeared for life. And because I had watched him, you know, having this sort of emotional reaction where the jury couldn't see it, that to me felt incredibly believable.
Yeah. Well, and regardless of where this ends up, if you want to talk about the speech act of an insult versus a defamation, if you want to talk about the exact timeline of what Musk knew and when did he know it, it really does seem like the joke of never tweet is actually really serious when you are a big public figure. Like, I am careful myself with my, you know, piddly follower count and my, you know, minor internet fame about saying anything that might be hurtful to somebody. It just seems incredibly reckless for somebody as famous as Elon Musk to just be throwing stuff out there.
You know, never tweet is not, like, to me, this is not a joke. It's just good advice.
Yeah.
It's advice I am literally never going to take, but it is good advice. And, like, I was, like, you know, like, part of the fun of this for me, the moments that were fun, were, like, listening to people read tweets aloud or, like, seeing them, like, presented on a big screen. And, like, I was thinking about, like, tweets I've done, and, like, I would definitely love to see my cat my cat tweets about how great my cat is on a big screen and, like, have a judge read them. But most of the rest of my tweets, no.
Tweets, you know, blown up on poster board in, like, Congress or in trial, just, like, you know, 5 feet wide, are never not funny.
It's true. Because they're so far out of context, right? Yeah. Like, we're within the context of no context these days. But, yeah, I mean, to me, like, that was really a message. Like, you know, message one, like, do research the right way. And message two, don't tweet. But yeah, I mean, that was to me like the headline here. Like, this is not the first time that Elon Musk has gotten in trouble because of his Twitter account.
Oh, are you suggesting that maybe he shouldn't have said he was going to take Tesla private? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I don't, like, personally, if I were a public figure, I probably also would not leave Twitter, but I would engage somebody who had my password. That I personally did not have, who could serve as a choke point for my bad tweets, and, like, say, like, are you sure you want to do this? Because one of the things that seems very clear to me from my own Twitter usage is that it's a pretty impulsive place.
Yeah.
You know, you, like, it's like a seething mass of id. And just having somebody, like, having to tell somebody what you want to tweet is usually a pretty good sounding board for whether it's a good tweet or not. And like not being able to access your own Twitter account seems like a net positive.
Yeah. If you're embarrassed to like say to somebody, I would like you to tweet this, then you shouldn't tweet it.
Yeah. So if you are listening to this and you're a public figure, that is my advice to you. Like, you don't necessarily have to delete your Twitter account, although like you could, like that would probably be the smartest thing you could do. But like maybe just like have an intermediary to make sure that you don't say dumb shit publicly.
Yeah. Don't say dumb shit publicly is probably a pretty good place to wrap up. So Liz, I'm gonna let you go cover the rest of the trial. Good luck. And, you know, don't J-dart. If you get back on Twitter,
I'll do my best not to. Honestly, like I can't wait to start tweeting about my cat again.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. ArmorAll, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Paul.
Yes.
Every single week, without fail,
that's right,
we introduce the segment the exact same way, which is we talk about its consistency and we never forget about it. We never screw it up because it always has the exact same name.
I've been thinking about taking a week off each year in honor of Cybertruck, but other than that, yes. It's always been called and will continue to be called In the Apocalypse, We Don't Need Space Bars. And this is a Cyberdeck. It's a Raspberry Pi Cyberdeck. And it's very hard to describe. So just imagine that you're in a William Gibson novel. And you also have a Raspberry Pi, and you need to, it's a waterproof case with a screen and some hardware switches that look really cool and kind of retro, and then a super impractical keyboard in the front, but it's, you know, real mechanical switches and stuff, but there's no space bar. I've been looking at the layout of this keyboard. This is a super custom project that somebody, it's basically a piece of art. That is like what would a rugged laptop look like in the apocalypse when, you know, you're driving your Cybertruck and then you need to like whip up a post-apocalyptic email to your tribe. And so you whip out your Cyberdeck and you type it up on this Raspberry Pi Cyberdeck. And I just don't know why. I really like those, you know, fancy keyboards where like you put all the keys in a grid, you know, and then you use kind of like cords to like get at all the extra functions and stuff. But there's just no space bar in here. I just don't know how you type without a space bar. And it's not like there's no room in the Cyberdeck.
I think you could ask any MacBook user what it's like to type without a space bar. You can figure it out.
Okay, well, fair.
Yeah. No. This thing actually looks really dope. I want to know what the switches are for. So it looks like a big plastic Pelican case and you like snap it open.
Yeah, I mean, you can switch on and off the display. So if you're just running the Pi as like a server, you can turn off the display. You can switch the power source up. And then it's got like GPIO breakouts. Just looks so cool. It's just, you know, it's like it's alternate history tech, but it's real working project based on a Raspberry Pi.
I don't know how to transition this to the founders of Google leaving, but I'm just that's just happening. Casey Newton, tell us what's going on, because Sergey and Larry just surprised us on a Tuesday afternoon, just sort of out of nowhere.
Well, I mean, I think it's possible that they heard about this new Raspberry Pi and they thought, we've got to start hacking on this thing. This is the future. No, so there we were, you know, sitting at our internet brain stations, minding our own business, and then word comes down the transom on the official Google blog that Larry and Sergey, who started their company 21 years ago, famously in Susan Wojcicki's garage.
Well, they started in a dorm.
They expanded into the garage. Well, they've decided that they have had enough, and that they are now going to merely be board members who retain total control over the company. So Google, of course, has dual class stock, and Larry and Sergey, you know, can kind of still decide what happens. But day to day, the person running it will be Sundar Pichai, who they elevated from running Android to running Google in 2015. Once they sort of reorganized the whole company so that it had an umbrella company over it called Alphabet, and now Sundar will be running Alphabet as well. And so that is what happened.
I need to talk about Alphabet for quite a while, but if you're not familiar, dual class stock, and Google was actually a pioneer in this shenanigan. There's two kinds of stock that you can own at Google. You can own regular plebe stock, or you can own super special, like I'm in charge stock. And they created this two class system, so they maintain 51% or whatever it is, control of the company. They can do whatever they want, and they can do whatever they want with the company, and nobody can say no to them. Not the board, not Sundar, not anybody.
And you might be saying, well, what would they do with that? Well, for example, they might set up part of Alphabet called Other Bets, a division of the company that managed to lose $941 million in the previous quarter.
Yeah.
Which is a thing that actually happened.
Mm-hmm. They also can say, well, you know, we actually, we don't run YouTube. We run Alphabet, which has Google as a division, and then YouTube is a division of Google. And that's just too far down the chain for us to have to report on financials for that. So we don't know how much money YouTube makes.
Right. And this has like been a huge frustration on the part of financial analysts for a while, because YouTube is obviously one of the biggest companies in the entire world, and we know almost nothing about its financial performance.
Yeah. So why now? So they're not going away. They're still going to be employees of the company, I'm told. They're still board members. They just don't want to manage anymore. But honestly, they could have done this a year and a half ago, and nobody would have batted an eye at it. They could have done it when they split out Alphabet in the first place. Like, why now?
So there are some competing theories about this, and we should say that all of these are 100% in the realm of speculation. We don't really have any reporting on this.
Yeah.
Many people have noted that this is a rough time for Google across a lot of dimensions. One, there are ongoing antitrust investigations into the company around the world. There are also other investigations related to data privacy and other issues. Larry and Sergey famously hated kind of interacting with the government in any way. Some people have speculated that they might have just wanted to avoid that.
Larry Page literally proposed, like, on stage at a massive Google event, that he wanted to start his own island where there would be no laws or regulations to stop him from making weird things.
He's kind of doing that too in Toronto.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sidewalk Labs.
Yeah.
So, there is that theory. Another theory is that they're very worried about an ongoing investigation that Google's or Alphabet's board is currently conducting into the shameful history in Google's C-suite of top executives, including both Larry and Sergey dating their subordinates.
Right.
The fact that they did this is on the record. We know that it happened. Some of the details are pretty bad. And so you can imagine when this report comes out, there could be a lot of internal unrest at Google seeking their ouster.
Right. Well, and there's already internal unrest at Google right now. Lots of employees starting in some ways with this history, with the revelation of Andy Rubin's payout. There was a huge Google walkout. There had been some agitation up to that point. But there's just a lot of organizing and a lot of fighting with management right now.
And I think that is the third major reason that people are speculating, is that there is this really large contingent of Googlers that is very unhappy about the way that the company has been managed with regard to the treatment of workers, with regard to payouts to, you know, men who have had credible charges of sexual misconduct. They have shown no interest in trying to quell those storms.
Yeah.
Have they been doing a bad job, would you say?
Have they been doing a bad job? Yes. Honestly, what has Alphabet done that is worth a damn since 2015 when the split, this thing happened.
I feel like if I, you know, through partial ingenuity, partial timing, partial luck, founded a trillion-dollar company, I would probably have done exactly what they did in terms of like, okay, this is up and running, but it's really just ads. So I'm going to go and invent weird stuff and maybe something will land and then I'll have like a second act and that'll be great. I totally get that, but that doesn't seem to have been like a really great strategy.
Well, I mean, what's not clear is that they took much of an active role in these projects. Like, you know, there are stories about them like wandering around the Project Loon offices, like looking at their balloons. Like Sergey was very interested in the autonomous vehicles for a long time. So, you know, they've checked in, but it's not like they're out there, you know, giving TED Talks or writing blog posts or really engaging on the issues around these other bets in any meaningful way. And so from the outside, it really does just look like they disappeared.
Well, the other thing that always rubbed me the wrong way is Alphabet fundamentally felt dishonest from the start. It was never, oh, we're forming this umbrella company. Google's a part of it. We're going to do a bunch of other amazing stuff. But it was always just Google. And the rest of this other corporate structure and these corporate shenanigans, and they're in charge of Alphabet, and there's a, you know, a group of CEOs running a bunch of different companies that are all, you know, co-equal with Google, it was always just Google. And everybody knew it.
Yeah, I mean, I am sympathetic to the idea that if you had a like financial engine that was throwing off more cash than almost anything in history, but that it was also an internet business, and so just as subject to being disrupted as any other internet business, you would invest an insane amount in research and development and in stuff that looks totally unrelated to the place where you had made your bones. Like, I think in retrospect, we will probably feel pretty good about their investment in what became Waymo, for example. Waymo may not be the winning autonomous vehicle company, and, you know, Andy reports on this, you know, all the time, but they really seeded a lot of that research. They made some of the big early advances, and, you know, they're going to be relatively early to the market, and maybe that becomes a huge business for them, right? And if and it's also the sort of thing where if only one of those other bets pays off in a Google level way, then the whole thing was arguably worth it.
Okay.
But for every Waymo, then you make it something like Kitty Hawk, which is this flying car startup that Larry Page has been funding. And apparently there was a great story that kind of flew under the radar on Forbes that came out last week, how they are returning deposits for the very first vehicle that they were planning on manufacturing, because it looks like they're probably not going to end up actually making it. It's this thing called the Flyer, which is sort of like this personal flying device that you can use over you know, bodies of water. And it looked like a lot of fun when they put out the first video, and now it's like, you know, it's this typical thing, this, you know, walking back the high expectations of this this flying car project that they were starting on the path of. So, you know, yeah, I agree. It's you know, you gotta diversify as much as you possibly can, but you gotta be smart about how you do that too.
Well, I think that the whole reason of making Alphabet the umbrella company was so that they could still be in charge and not have anybody ask them why they weren't giving up their 51% control. Because a much more natural way to do it is just have Google Ventures like fund a bunch of companies on the side and they run some of those companies. The end, right? That's like, that makes way more sense to me. And now we have the situation where Sundar Pichai is running Google and also Google's parent company at the same time. Fine. It's all one company anyway. That's how I feel about it. But I am going to be very curious to see what he and Ruth Porat, the CFO, start doing with those other bets. Are they going to start just like holding these other, you know, random Alphabet companies to account to, you know, put up or shut up? Or are they going to continue to let them sort of do what they do?
Well, here's where it gets interesting, because if you've heard one thing about Sundar Pichai, it's probably that he's very nice, right? And it's because, like,
Because it's literally true.
It's very true. And so it's hard to imagine him transforming into the corporate Grim Reaper, right?
Right.
Some people believe that Ruth Porat actually already has been that, mm-hmm. that Reaper in a lot of ways. And so maybe she will sort of be empowered to go swing the scythe and get rid of, I don't know, Verily or Calico or, you know, some of these other divisions that they're spinning up now. But I don't know. I've read some interesting analysis over the past day or so that has said this is the most likely outcome of Google being run by Sundar is that he is going to focus on the core money-making businesses, which are Google and YouTube, mm-hmm. to the at the expense of everything else. And if that happens, then this is going to be actually a really significant deal and a kind of significant re-transformation of Google. You know, there was a lot of what I thought was really dumb tech punditry out there in the aftermath of this move where people are like, it doesn't matter. This was basically the case anyway. It's like, no, like the people protecting seven of Alphabet's divisions don't work there anymore.
Well, but they're still around and they're still going to give advice on things that they're passionate about or whatever the line was. So there is the question of like, is nothing changing because they're still going to be there, like, you know, exercising soft power in some way? Are they like, what's the, they're going to be like, you know, the advisor behind the king, right?
Right. The power behind the throne.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, we don't know because they have essentially been living on Mars for the past 5 years.
Yeah. I mean, my sense is, I put this in my piece, like Sundar got to where he is, not just by being a nice guy, but his job was making good products and taking things that were essentially in beta and finalizing them and then putting them out the door. He made Chrome out of nothing. That Google didn't even like Larry Page didn't even really want to make a browser, and he's like, no, this is really good, and you know, off to the races. He did the same thing with Gmail, G Suite. He professionalized all of their consumer apps, so to speak. And so if he sees the potential to like make any of those Alphabet things real, I think that he could definitely pull it off. Mm-hmm. But I think that right now there's more than enough to deal with all the regulation, all of the employee unrest, some of which is very well justified, all of the crap that's happening on YouTube. Like, now is not a great time for Sundar Pichai to all of a sudden have a whole lot more crap on his plate.
Right.
I mean, if you're a tech founder right now, I think leaving on your own terms is probably way more preferred than getting kicked to the curb, as some other examples we've seen in recent history.
Yeah. It is interesting that now Microsoft and Apple and Google, all three are run by like trusted lieutenants who had a track history of executing well and not being, you know, wild and angry and crazy and weird.
And they've really been pretty successful, mm-hmm. right? Like Satya Nadella had like turned around Microsoft in a really impressive way. Tim Cook has been a pretty steady hand at the wheel, and I think, like, you know, as somebody who is at least somewhat skeptical of him, like, he managed to launch very successful products that I don't think Steve Jobs was, you know, aware of or were, you know, just in a still pretty embryonic stage, and that was not, you know, a given when Steve Jobs died. Sundar Pichai has been a steady hand at the wheel for Google. The financial performance is has been really good. Mm-hmm. The stock price is up. So yeah, it is interesting that three of our biggest tech giants are run by these kind of heirs to the founders.
Yeah. I have nothing else to say about Google. I mean, I do, but I'm going to let it go. The nice thing is that they only announced one new messaging app this week alongside this. So, I mean, good on them.
The photos messaging?
Photos Messenger.
Which actually, like, jokes aside, is a really good idea, because sharing photos in Google Photos before was a nightmare. It was just awful.
You bringing up Microsoft really made me think, like, what are the things that Google and Microsoft both have a cloud component, and they both have like a cloud office component. And you really get the sensation that Microsoft thinks of those as very important and strategic for the future of their company. Mm-hmm. And Google has thought of them as, it'd be nice if we were successful at this, you know?
Yeah, I think they actually do think it's more critical for their future. Google really does want to diversify its revenue streams outside advertising. But they actually need to commit harder. And I think that for Google to commit harder, like say for hardware, for example, for Google to actually commit on hardware, it would have to actually commit real, like, lose a ton of money marketing resources to its products. And then if it flopped, it looks really bad. But they do want to make money off of stuff other than ads. And in the cloud stuff in particular, that's just like, that's a big whiff for them. They've had bad management. They didn't know how to like sell to companies. They didn't have the right sales teams, and you know, on and on and on. So they've actually rebooted that again in like the past year and a half. So I think you're right that it's not core to them and like it's not, doesn't feel existential to them. But I think the 5-year view is that if Google is still making 98% of its money off ads, then it's going to be in trouble.
Well, and then that would be interesting to see if a future of Google is to, instead of losing $500 million on some crazy project, you know, lose $500 million on trying to win at Docs, you know?
Right.
That'd be kind of wild.
God, I would love it if Google just said, we've decided to invest an additional $500 million into Docs, and then maybe it would default to a blank 8.5 by 12 sheet of paper in the year 2019 maybe, every time you started a new document.
Maybe it would work on the iPad.
Dieter, please don't get crazy. We only have $500 million to work with here, okay? You're nuts.
All right, we've run pretty long. In the last couple of minutes, Paul, what the hell is going on in Hawaii with Qualcomm?
Qualcomm's done it again. They said that they couldn't make another flagship. Where will they go from here with the 855? Well, they made the 865.
What?
I know. It's pretty wild. So
some people thought they would go to 856, and they just blew right by it.
That's right. It's such a leap this year. They're claiming about like a 25% improvement. A lot of horsepower seems available for the camera, which is pretty exciting. There's like they say they could capture 8K at 30 frames per second, which is pretty wild. Notably, the 5G modem is not built in.
My understanding is there's no modem built into the 865 at all, which means that, you know, you'll get this processor, you need to go get a modem, and most people are just going to go get the modem that Qualcomm sells that works with it, which is a 5G modem.
Right. But it is a better 5G this year. Yep. So they're upgrading that and notably with better support for like lower. My big thing, I really want T-Mobile's 600 megahertz network to just to be the best thing ever. Because I'm having real problems with my Verizon coverage lately, where it's because especially it's like I'm in a building and I don't have Wi-Fi. And Verizon's network just doesn't want to find me inside of the building. And it's like, well, why am I paying you? You know, I'm not supposed to use my phone while I'm driving, you know? So like, I'm usually inside of buildings, you know? And if I don't get coverage from you while I'm inside, you know? So I really like the idea of 600 megahertz. So I wish T-Mobile the best of luck. And so they're the new 5G modem should be better with that stuff.
Yeah, T-Mobile's network is deployed. I think the only phone that works on it, you can start buying tomorrow, I think it is, or today when you're listening to this, it's the OnePlus 7 something Pro McLaren Special Edition 5G or whatever. Mm. We're going to be out and testing it. Streets of New York, we've got one. So stay tuned for that, or it might be up by the time you listen to this. The 865 seems fine. I'm more excited that the mid-range is getting better because I think that we're going to be getting to a place where, like, you can get a good phone and not feel bad about having the like second tier processor.
Yeah. So the 765 is the new mid-range. It does have built-in 5G, and I'm super into, like, I don't need, thankfully, you know, I don't need to capture 8K at 30 frames per second. So like, thankfully I get to make a choice in the next year or two to buy a phone with hopefully better battery life. And good wireless, and I don't think I just don't feel like I need these flagships anymore. But you know, obviously they're still pushing it and they're still improving the speed. Qualcomm also announced new Windows ARM 8C and 7C, but I didn't know this, but there's no 8CX laptops shipping yet.
The only real one that was announced is a Samsung, and they just haven't. They just like haven't released it. It's in the same warehouse where they keep all the Bixby speakers. You know, they just haven't thought to like, oh yeah, we should put these in stores yet. So yeah, the only the SQ1 has shipped, which is a variant of the 8CX. But Qualcomm shipping new ARM Windows laptops before anybody's bought a single one of their previous generation seems weird to me. I don't know. That, friends, is the entirety of the Vergecast. Before I let you go, I want to plug a bunch of stuff because this has actually been just a gangbusters week at The Verge. In addition to the stories we've already talked about, Zoe Schiffer posted an amazing feature on Away, the suitcase maker, and just the horrific culture that happened in there. You got to read these Slack logs. You heard Addie on The Vergecast before. She had a great piece on how to find the truth on the internet. Colin Letcher had an amazing piece on a caper involving tracking e-waste across the globe using a hidden GPS unit. You know, we talked about Liz on Elon, and then we had just a ton of great features about the 25th anniversary of the PlayStation that Andrew Webster put together with, like, basically the whole staff. So you should go check all that stuff out. We'll put some links in the show notes. And there are other podcasts from the Vox Media Podcast Network, of which we are the flagship, by the way, that you should go listen to. One in particular I think you'll like is Reset with Ariel DeHaim-Ross. It comes out three or so times a week, and it is really close looks at the biggest stories that are happening that day. So go check that out. I am on Twitter. I am at Backlon. Neil is Reckless. He's not here. Casey is Casey Newton. Andy is Andy Jayhawk.
That's right.
Hey, and Paul is Future Paul. Thanks for listening.
Rock and roll. Paul.
Paul.
Cybertruck forever.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.